us. We can defeat this tiny sword and then make her evaluate the stock with us. She can probably help us separate the second-born winner from all the losers. Grisham arches an eyebrow at me, as if he's just seeing me for the first time. Maybe you're right. Tomorrow, we'll see what she knows. The sinister voice of my nightmares interrupts.
Firstborn Commander, might I take my leave now so that I may begin my investigation?
Agent Crow gives Raiken a lip-curling scowl. My belly quivers at the sight of his steely teeth. Grisham makes a shooing gesture with his hand, dismissing Agent Crow.
Yes, yes. Go and report back.
The death tally notches by Agent Crow's eyes are the feathers of a black bird, twitching before flight. Whatever he's planning, it's coming soon. Chapter 7. The God's Table. When I return to my apartment, I'm met outside the door by the cold, assessing look of a second-born diamond-faded attendant. I was supposed to meet Crystal here over 2 hours ago to get ready for the gods and goddesses ball. Dune arranged for her help because I have no one else, Phoenix being utterly incapable of helping me dress for a costume party. Crystal's disapproving frown makes me remember that I'm still in my silver bikini with only a long towel wrapped around my waist. I look like a layabout.
I'm sorry I'm late. I apologize.
The sole of her dangerously sharp high-heeled shoe taps against the marble floor in decisive clicks. She's a slight woman in her early 60s. Her silvery hair is pulled back in a severe knot, but it doesn't hide her beauty. I was on lockdown at the...
I'm second-born. No explanations necessary for wasting my time.
Apparently, Crystal is a master at the passive-aggressive arts. My cheeks heat with a blush.
Can I help you with your things? I ask.
Over her thin arm is a black garment bag. Under it is a long box. Clutched in her other milky white hand is the black handle of a large black case. The case hovers above the ground. Judging by her small frame and the enormity of the bulky, coffin-like box, I doubt she could carry it. The stress lines around her mouth pucker in disapproval.
I'm capable of performing my duties, comes her clipped response. Please hurry. We have less time now.
I've selected a non-goddess character to impersonate this evening. After Dune informed me of the invitation to the ball and assigned Crystal to help, I explained to her via hologram that I wanted to go as Rosalyn. She's not technically a goddess. She was Tyburn's lover. I first saw Rosalind's image on the side of the Tyburn Fountain, the monument to the god of the West Wind. Rosalind points to the door that ultimately leads inside the Sword Palace grounds. Hawthorne kissed me in that fountain. I can still feel it. All the costume entails is a crown of roses and a skimpy gown. Done. I close the door behind Crystal. Phoenix's clanging footsteps ring in the hall. He greets us with the bright red glow of his eyes. Crystal's already severe disdain turns to scorn at the sight of Phoenix.
What is that creature? She asks, recoiling.
My mechadome. It's harmless. I'm pretty sure that it's Phoenix, and not Raiken, greeting me now, because I left Raiken in the bathhouse with Grisham and the others. I'll have to watch the mechadome to see if it gets clingy. The minute that happens, I'll know Raiken is at the controls.
Where would you like to work? I ask.
Crystal gives Phoenix a wide berth as she passes. She stops in the drawing room, her black coffin case still hovering by her side.
This will do.
She lets go of the black handle and touches her blue diamond moniker. The crate opens and unfolds, becoming a vanity with a mirror and studio lights. Crystal hangs the garment bag on a hook on its side and sets the long box beside it. She lifts an ornate, gold-leaf-encrusted chair from near the bureau and places it in front of the vanity.
Please, sit.
After I do, she opens a drawer that contains ropes of thorny vines and small red roses in various stages, from buds to full bloom. She pulls on gloves with polymer protectors on the fingertips and palms and immediately goes to work on my hair,
creating a halo effect with a crown. She braids thorny vines into the full length of the long hair in the back, weaving the rosebuds and blooms into the thorns and around the crown. It's a decidedly un-Rosalind-like look. Tyburn's lover was soft, with flowing hair. This is very warrior-like. This reminds me of... I stand up just as Crystal is about to place another rosebud. Opening the garment bag on the hook, I spread it wide. Instead of a flowy medieval peasant gown, I find an ancient warrior goddess ensemble consisting of a fawn-colored leather halter that will barely cover my breasts. It laces in the back, but leaves the shoulders and midriff bare. Low-rise leather pants of the same hue and a primitive cut hang behind it, and a tight vest of brown suede with a brown fur mantle hangs behind that. What is this? Your attire for this evening. Crystal eyes it with approval. This isn't what we discussed. No, it's not. Why did you change it? Your name is Roselle. You should be the goddess of war, your namesake. I don't want to be the goddess of war. I want to be Tyburn's lover. Crystal's austere posture takes on an even more rigid mien. Why would you be subservient to a god when you could be the goddess who presides over him? I blink. I have no good answer except to say, that's not the point. It's exactly the point. But it wasn't me who changed your request. It was Commander Codaline. So you should bring it up with him if you have a problem with it. Now, if there's nothing further, I'd like to continue my work. I want to argue, but I know that she's just following instructions, so I relent. I sit back down, and she releases a small handheld drone into the air. The drone flies in close, airbrushing makeup onto my face. It draws an intricate vine of inky thorns on the side, beginning above my eyebrow and drawing sharp points near my eye and over my cheek and jaw. Continuing down my throat and over my shoulder, the thorns grow down my arm and wrap around my right index finger. Crystal directs me to stand. The drone inks more thorny vines down the side of my abdomen. When it's finished, the little drone flies back to Crystal's hand, and she returns it to a drawer in the vanity. The makeup dries instantly. With Crystal's help, I dress as the goddess Roselle. She ties the bodice laces, and I take care of the rest. Reaching for the box, she extracts long mocha-hued suede boots. The boots are lined at the tops with brown fur and reach to just below my knees. The leather pants tuck into them. Without the suede and the fur mantle of the vest, my thorny braids would slice my skin to ribbons. Crystal pulls out an iron belt with sharp, rose-shaped throwing stars attached to it. Careful, she warns as I take it. Those roses detach. The petals have razor-sharp edges. I arch an eyebrow. Why? She gestures to my fusion blade, which sits on a nearby chair. You can't take that with you. Fear threatens to bury me, but I try not to show it. Dune told me of your need to defend yourself, given the recent attempt on your life. We came up with these as a compromise. You'll need these also. From the box, she extracts iron bracers, the kind that archers used to wear. Clamping them on my wrists, she says, turn the rose counterclockwise. I turn the intricate iron rose on the left bracer. A dagger ejects from inside the hollow sheath and locks into place above my palm. I grip its handle. It's stiff and hard to wield, but useful. I turn the rose clockwise, and it disappears inside the bracer. Crystal steps back and appraises me with a critical eye. What do you think? I ask. It needs one last thing. From the bottom drawer of the vanity, she takes out an iron crown with 9 sharp, sword-shaped points. She asks me to sit, and then she sets it on top of my head, positioning it so that it's wreathed by my halo of hair, thorns, and roses. I gaze in the mirror. The image is unmistakably powerful. I'd fight with Roselle. Die for her, and what she represents. Crystal murmurs, I wouldn't lift a finger to help Rosalyn. Decide who you are, so I know if it's worth risking my life for you. You're an old woman who is tired of the way things are. She turns from me and touches her moniker. The vanity folds away again, back into a hovering case. She hands me goggles with rose-colored lenses. Now, let me tell you about the bracer on your right wrist. The waning sun is blocked by tall, intricate marvels of architecture that are the hallmark of the City of Purity. Each building is more impressive than the last. My reflection in the elegant hovercar's window shines with street lamp eyes. The image of the iron crown upon my head slices the growing darkness and twinkles, mirroring the lights outside. Lounging beside me in the back seat, Dune is the heart of darkness in his God of Dawn outfit. His boots are ebony. The dark black fabric of his trouser legs tucks inside them, lightening to a softer shade toward his waist. His shirt is an even fainter shade of black, turning to gold as it reaches his shoulders. A golden, lion-like fur mantle covers his shoulders. His cape attaches to it, gold on the inside, and night turning to golden sun on the outside. Our hover car comes to a stop as we queue up for the extravagant costume gala. A slow-moving line of expensive vehicles leads to an enormous hovering glass building with seven towers jutting up from it. A frosty veneer decorates the massive structure, which appears to balance on the head of a thin needlepoint above the calm, glass-like surface of a deep lake, resembling a floating crystalline formation. A brilliant, burning pink sunset presides. The water beneath reflects the building in the fuchsia sky, the mirrored image like an alternate universe. The building is only one way in from the ground level, a hauntingly beautiful transparent bridge that reminds me of ice shards frozen in a winter gale. Our hover car stops in front of the wide bridge. Ushers, dressed as fantastical snow people, stand on either side of the glacial-looking supports. Frost-covered hair and skin shimmer in the glowing lights of the street lamps. The ushers have the torsos of men and women, but the lower halves of their bodies are encased in films of faux ice, blurring them. A particularly tall iceman opens my door and reaches to help me out. The brown mountain range of his second-born moniker hovers above the back of his hand. I grip his fingers and step into the night air. His eyes fall on my silver sword moniker, widening before moving up to my face. I can assure you I was invited, I murmur. His smile is anything but icy. Of course. You're Roselle St. Sismode. I'm Roselle Sword, I correct him. A warm breeze blows. I had been expecting wintriness. You look like Roselle, the goddess of war, to me. I glance down at myself and laugh self-effacingly. Only for tonight. His smile fades. Let us hope not. Dune emerges to stand beside me. The golden fur mantle covering his shoulders makes him appear even stronger, lion-hearted. The attendant's eyes travel up Commander Codaline's powerful build, and the second-born says, My master, Hale, the god of ice and flurry, welcomes you to his social club. This is all a bit silly, but I play along. Thank you. Dune simply nods. Please, the usher continues, allow me to escort you to the doors. His arm sweeps in the direction of the bridge. That won't be necessary, Dune says, taking my arm in his. We walk to the north-facing bridge. Firstborns, mostly swords, garbed in costumes ranging from the ridiculous to the sublime, stroll near us, all moving in the direction of the shimmering ice fortress. The bridge is a marvel of design, with a long arch that doesn't appear to have any support between its two ends. Beneath us, the water is so clear and deep that it's not hard to imagine that we're the ones walking upside down in a different world. Before us, enchanting snowflake-shaped doors roll open. Pairs of diamond-faded secondborns greet us inside the doors. One young woman is garbed in a tight, icy bodice. Her counterpart wears a fiery red ensemble, her skin licked with decorative flames. The one with the short blue bob and snowflake-patterned skin scans my moniker with a handheld device. You have a VIP all-access pass. Are you ready for a seat at the God's table? Or are the depths of the underworld more to your liking? Her red-headed counterpart asks. Dune's eyebrows slash together, and his demeanor becomes stern.
We're here to see the host,
he replies with an air of authority. Of course, the blue one says, all business now. You'll need these to reach the God's table at the summit. You'll find the God of Ice and Fury there. She points up before handing us both a set of hover discs. The round metallic pieces are each about 2 inches in diameter. Lifting my boot, I press one to my sole. It latches onto the stiff leather. I do the same with the other foot. The hover mode engages and lifts me several inches off the floor. I can access the controls of the hover discs through my moniker because they're attached to me and therefore not blocked. We walk forward, only we don't touch the ground. Rise and fall in the recommended channels, or you're liable to get hurt, the red one warns us. I gaze back over my shoulder to watch the greeters fawn over the next arrival, a decadent, bare-chested god with a very lethal-looking white snake wrapped around his broad shoulders. The fiery greeter directs him to the left and over to a dark ballroom, where a sinister fog and a flare of hellfire creeps over the threshold. He sees me watching him and sends me a sultry air kiss. Ahead is a winter palace. Icy fog covers a glass floor. Costumed firstborns use it like an ice rink, only their feet never touch the surface. Above the rink, a holographic field displays a scene from last year's secondborn trials, where several of the contestants from different fates were forced to cross an icy lake. Some tried to tread where the ice was too thin and fell through. Others waited too long for the ice to harden, dying of hypothermia before reaching the other side, freezing solid during the night. A group that constructed primitive sleds to distribute their weight did well. Others assembled hover discs to accomplish the crossing. The ingenuity of the various competitors is astounding, but watching the losers makes my belly ache. Dune and I move away from the rink. We find a channel, essentially a dedicated path leading upward. The building has tiers of floors, but in the middle, there's open air up to the ceiling. As we rise through the channel, we pass an ice wall with firstborn swords clinging to its surface, using glacial pickaxes and cliff boots with hover discs to make the climb a breeze. A holographic field in the cliff depicts three-dimensional secondborns in a challenge in last year's secondborn trials. The contestants were required to climb a treacherous mountain to obtain golden ration tickets that could be used to purchase food supplies. My mood sours as I watch the footage. Cyborg mountain lions pounce on sun-faded secondborns who couldn't climb fast enough. Their bodies are torn apart in the most horrific ways. The drone cameras cut away to a moon-faded team. The climb up is simply too much for one. He calls something to his partner before letting go of the ledge. My heart pounds, watching his body free fall into the mist below. His partner chooses not to continue the climb, letting go as well and falling to her death. The terror of that moment must have been excruciating. I shudder. Dune whispers in my ear, "Remember all of the things you'll no longer tolerate when you have the power to change them." We reach the top of the tallest tower and power off our hover discs, preferring to walk on solid ground. Security is tight here. Firstborn exos and secondborn sword soldiers stand in position all around the penthouse level of the tallest tower. Stingers hover in legions. Dune and I are subjected to a battery of security checkpoints, including body scans for high-tech weaponry. I wait for a soldier to balk at my belt of razor-sharp roses or the bracers on my wrists. No one does. Do they consider these weapons merely decorative? Ahead, large golden gates representing the entrance to the kingdom of the gods lie open, awaiting the chosen few. This is the gallery level. Dimly lit, it gives an impressive view of the ballroom below. The gilded railing is shaped like a horseshoe and decorated with ancient deities. At the far end, opposite me, is a wall of glass windows, providing a view of the cloudless night sky. The gods on this level are nefarious at best. I can't help thinking, as I observe them frivolously spilling their cocktails and grinding on each other, that they've been the ruin of secondborns. Some are swathed in latex and lace. Others are bathed in cosmic fog and little else, each paying a tribute to different gods and goddesses from recorded history. Below us, down a sparkling glass staircase, is the ballroom's main floor. In the center of the room is the god's table, an elevated, gothic-columned platform where the elite of the sword aristocracy have gathered to play games of chance. Bright lights stream from it. Elaborate gilded tables, shiny with animated holographic figurines resembling secondborn competitors from all the fates, do battle in different gaming scenarios. On the dance floor surrounding the god's table, couples sway to driving music performed by a diamond-faded man resembling the god of thunder. The glass ceiling above him is an awning against the sky. A gray-bearded firstborn with a wide mouth, dressed as the god of the sea, stands at the top of the stairs, announcing arriving socialites. His salt-laden eyebrows weigh heavily over the creases of his eyes, which scrutinize me. "The tide has swept in a prize." The deep rumble of his voice is amplified and echoes around us. He opens his fist, and out swim tiny holographic porpoises that disappear after sailing by. He leers at my cleavage. I could kill him with the trident in his hand. That thought makes me smile. "I'm no one's prize," I reply, passing him and descending the glass steps.
"Roselle, the goddess of war," he bellows behind me.
His gravelly voice carries, coinciding with the final chords of the God of Thunder's song. His announcement of Dune is lost in the collective gasp from the crowd. Nearly everyone on the floor, and in the gallery, turns to us. I'd give anything to be the goddess of peace at this moment. War is easy to perpetuate. Peace, on the other hand, is nearly impossible. It will be hard won, if it's achieved at all. The crowd in front of me parts. Thankfully, the music starts again, so I'm not subjected to the hissing whispers of the revelers. A mixture of hostility, pointed stares, and open admiration pummels my invisible armor. I lift my chin. Dune takes my wrist. We thread through the firstborns on the dance floor. A watery moat and glistening fountains wind around the god's table, separating it from the dancers. To reach the table, we cross a small arched bridge and climb a short flight of stone steps. Passing between gothic stone columns, we emerge on the other side of a glittering, transparent sound barrier. The music from the God of Thunder fades, replaced by high-pitched voices and cheering from firstborns crowded around gaming tables. Within the chaos and revelry of the blinking lights, I find Clifton. He has taken a position at the far end of this exclusive club. Seated amid a table of gamers, he's engaged in a rousing match of pyramid conspiracy. I know the card game well. The arms dealer himself taught me how to play it. It's a game at which he particularly excels, and he loves this diversion. But by the way his eyes drift over me, I get the sense that cards are the furthest thing from his mind. Clifton sets his hand aside, opting out of the match in which he has a substantial bet placed. The officiator takes the stack of chips away without a word. Clifton gets to his feet, lifting his shiny cigar case from the table. He opens it and extracts a thin blue cigar. Putting it to his lips, he lights the end with a flame from the case. Blue smoke rises into the air. He snaps the case closed, rubbing the pad of his thumb on the smooth metal surface. The rigid set of his shoulders relaxes. His normal blonde whiplash of bangs is swept back into a knot at his crown. He's dressed as Cassius, the ancient lord of rays and ruin, with golden sickle attached to a wide leather belt over a rustic kilt. Thick leather straps crisscross his otherwise bare chest. At the center, where the leathers meet, a gold circle glints. Etched into the thick metal is the face of a rose. A long rust-colored cape hangs from his broad shoulders. With the face of a film star, he reminds me more of a sun god than a harbinger of annihilation. I can't help the smile that forms on my lips. Clifton's sultry green eyes pass over me, their golden fleck shining. I stop in front of him. He leans over to the table, crushes out the blue cigar, straightens, and reaches out, teasing a small rosebud from my hair. Stroking the delicate flower, he brings it to his nose and inhales its scent. The gesture is surprisingly intimate. "I've been worried about you," he says softly, as if no one else is around. "I'm okay," I reply. "I'm bored, actually. I have very little to do now that I've been working for Grisham." "That isn't what I heard. I heard there was an attempt on your life." His eyes drift accusingly to Dune's, pure malice seething in them. "No one's protecting you."
"She has my protection," Dune replies with polite menace.
Thinly veiled hostility marks Clifton's tone. "Those assassins should never have gotten to her." He rarely loses his cool, and the rage that contorts his normally playful expression surprises me. I try to reassure him. "I don't need protection, Clifton. I'm a second-born sword. You know this." I look around to see who else is listening, and my eyes fall on Valdi Kingfisher, seated at the table next to where Clifton had been. I recognize him as the bookmaker we sold arms to earlier in the year. I know his last name probably isn't Kingfisher. At Salloway Munitions, we replaced last names with bird names to protect clients' anonymity. Valdi's powerfully built, with a thick red scar that runs from his temple to his cheek. The brutal-looking man at the table rises and grins. Clifton swings his hand in the direction of the firstborn sword. "Roselle, may I introduce Valdi Schelling, your host for this evening?" I pretend not to know him. "I'm pleased to meet you, firstborn Schelling. Thank you for your kind invitation." His lips twitch with repressed amusement.
"It is my honor."
He takes my hand in his and kisses the back of it, an unlikely welcome for a secondborn. It makes me uncomfortable. Others might draw the wrong conclusions. I tug my fingers from his. "You have a lovely social club." The word club seems wrong. Glass palace is probably more fitting.
"Thank you. Most of the guests at the God's Table are members of the Rose Garden Society. It's usually not like this. The theme is my wife's doing."
He gestures toward a young firstborn woman attired in a sparkling silver gown with icicles dripping from it. Her delicate hand rests on the arm of the rugged-looking god of rain and shines with a golden sword moniker. The stormy deity holds a pair of ice and puts them to her mouth, and she blows on them with a sensual purse of her lips. Wintry snowflakes emerge from between them. A clever trick. The rain god brings the dice to his own lips and kisses them before shaking his fist and tossing them across the table. Tiny storm clouds follow the dice, raining as they tumble and bounce across the table.
"The Snow Queen has outdone herself tonight," Valdi continues.
He says it with a sour note, watching his wife fawn over the rain god at her side.
"Take my advice, Salloway. Don't wait too long to settle down. All the good ones will be taken."
Clifton gazes at me with surprising heat. "Oh, I intend to leave nothing to chance when it comes to that." Dune moves nearer to me, his annoyance plain.
"Do you always make your wishes aloud, Salloway?" he asks.
Clifton's laugh is humorless.
"I do when it's warranted. So, you're the god of dawn?"
"The dawn to end all nights." "Does she know what you're selling?" Clifton asks with a nod in my direction.
"What am I selling?"
Clifton leans in, His pointed finger touches Dune's chest. You're peddling the end of the world.
I could say the same of you. Does Roselle know about the Rose Garden Society's endgame?
Dune asks.
What's to know?
Clifton asks. We're but a group bent on making the world a more beautiful place, one garden at a time.
The more you sell, the more you're bought, Dune replies.
Clifton's expression turns stormy.
You cannot protect her like I can.
Roselle has a destiny, Dune says. If you're smart, you'll be a part of it. If not, you'll be a casualty of it.
Valdi moves between Dune and Clifton, separating the two.
I suggest privacy for a discussion such as this, he says.
He scans the room and waves his meaty hand in the air. A secondborn stone hurries forward.
Show these gentlemen to my private retreat.
The servant nods and gestures to Clifton and Dune to follow him.
Reluctantly, Clifton nods.
He faces me.
I'll find you when we're finished.
It sounds as if you plan to discuss my future, I say. Don't you think I should be present for that?
Clifton finds my hand and squeezes it.
You should enjoy the party.
Around me flutters a garish display of excess. I know there are secondborns who at this very moment shiver in battlefield bunkers, while here, firstborns are packed in every corner of the dance floor, dry ice fog blowing on them to keep them cool.
I don't like parties.
He cracks a smile. Strong fingers cup my chin.
No, you're far too serious.
I'll teach you how to have fun, I promise.
Turning from me, Clifton and Dune follow the secondborn stone. I stare broodingly after them until they disappear in the crowd and out onto one of the rooftop terraces at the back of the palace. I consider following them to see if I can eavesdrop on their conversation, but I'm distracted by the amplified voice of the god of the sea.
Robin, the god of retribution.
I turn to see my father at the top of the staircase.
Chapter 8. No Way to Slow. A soft billow of black mist floats around my father, Kennet Abjorn, god of retribution. He gazes down at the packed crowd as if he were born to rule them. Elegant black eel skin covers him, and thick wolf fur adorns the mantle of the black cape covering his wide shoulders. His hair is dark and slicked back, different than how he normally wears it. But nothing disguises that he's the fated sword, my father. Ebony ram's horns protrude from either side of his head. Three women dressed as vengeful night spirits accompany him, curving themselves around him. His virtue-faded moniker shines against the cheek of the woman his hand rests against. There's no possibility of his spotting me in the crowd. Heavy agony stabs at my chest. The last time I saw him was at my former home, the Sword Palace, the night they tried to kill me. Was he a part of the decision to murder me? His presence tests my heart's mettle. My father turns and makes his way along the gallery, mingling with throngs of costumed revelers. I take a step in the direction of the stairs, but Valdi's hand on my upper arm makes me pause.
You need to go to Clifton. Now.
Why? Valdi motions to his security. Armed sword guards materialize from the crowd.
Because your father wasn't invited tonight.
Confusion crosses my face.
You mean he's crashing your party?
I mean, I don't know why he's here.
Maybe he wants to see me.
Perhaps, Valdi replies skeptically. He nods and the armed guards close in on us.
I'll go ask him why he's here, I insist.
Valdi's grip tightens on my arm.
Clifton wants.
I'm going to speak to my father. I shake him off me. Valdi's sword security tries to block my path to the stairs, but I change direction and make my way to one of the long sword banners attached to the metal framework of the glass ceiling. Climbing the fabric like a rope, I reach the gallery level. The crowd beneath me cheers as if I'm a performing monkey here to entertain them. Swinging my legs, I gain enough momentum to hurtle over the gallery's glass railing. Applause erupts around me.
I ignore it. My mind races. If my father wasn't invited by the host, then who invited him? Chills slip down my spine. What will I say to him? Our last encounter was filled with bitterness. Still, I need to talk to him. Weaving my way through the people in the gallery, I pass large rooms with more gaming tables, others offering strange cuisine, and still others that are completely nefarious. I scan each room for my father. Nothing. I turn the corner into a new hallway, which is domed like a tunnel. The walls and ceiling project wintry scenes. Holographic snow falls around me. The rooms along this corridor are much smaller than the others. Virtual rooms. I pause at one, activating a program that transforms it into a salacious dungeon. I back away and press another with an open door. A few steps past it, I'm captured around the waist and dragged back into the room. The door slams. My cheek is pressed to the wall by a hand that covers my mouth. I throw my elbow back and simultaneously attempt to use my heel to crush my assailant's shin. The man behind me avoids both strikes. He whispers, "Is that any way to say hello?" My eyes widen. A small squeak slips from me. He loosens his hand on my mouth, and I turn in his arms. "Hawthorne," I whisper. Stormcloud eyes meet mine. His sandy hair is hidden beneath an ancient golden helmet. The faceplate has eye slits angled in a fierce scowl. The gold nose guard comes to a sharp point. Cheek protection follows the contours of his chiseled face. A golden half-moon shape adorns the crest of his helmet, slicing through the center of it, Deathhawk style. Only his full lips are exposed. He's dressed as Tyburn, the god of the West Wind. A crimson cape hangs from his powerful shoulders. His chest is encased in a hard brown leather hauberk. A warrior's leather skirt stops at his mid-thighs, showing his powerful legs in tall leather sandals. His bare arms are cuffed with golden circlets that highlight the sheer enormity of his biceps. A round golden shield is strapped to his back, covering the crimson cape. He sheds the shield, setting it beside us. My knees weaken. He doesn't wait for me to catch my breath. Strong lips cover mine in a searing kiss. His large, calloused hands glide over my shoulders to my neck. The contact sends shockwaves of sensation straight through my belly. My lips part. I exhale. Hawthorne's tongue infiltrates my mouth. I lean into him. My fingers splay over his hard chest. My heart pounds. Blood floods my cheeks, turning them rosy and hot. "I found you," he murmurs. His fingers slip to my nape. Sharp thorns from the vines in my hair dig into the backs of his hands. He hisses, but he doesn't pull away. I break our kiss, taking one of his hands in mine. His blood drips in tears from the scrapes. My thumb runs over the top of it, wiping at his wounds. "The thorns cut you," I murmur. "Worth it," he growls. Hawthorne leans down and kisses me again. "I was afraid you were dead," I whisper. Tears brighten my eyes. I'm having a hard time containing my emotions. "I'm devoted to you, Roselle," he whispers, "and you know it." In this moment, I could believe he's a god with supernatural powers, capable of destroying all my enemies. His hands move down my back and cup my butt. He lifts me in his arms. My legs encircle his narrow waist, and he presses my back against the wall. His hard torso rocks against me. Heat bursts in my core. Every nerve in my body strains to get closer to him. I want to snatch his golden helmet from his head so that I can see his face. My back brushes against a control panel on the wall, and the lights dim. The walls and ceiling become an ominous, darkening sky. Storm clouds gather on the horizon. "Where have you been?" Hawthorne groans, like he's in agony, but he continues to ravage my mouth. A rumble of thunder reverberates. The deep sound penetrates my soul. Brilliant flashes of lightning ripple through the landscape, turning it white, and then gold, and then gray. Gusts blow across a field of barley, the stalks bowing in the wind. "I couldn't find you," he says, breathing the words. "Halo Palace," I whisper. The silver moniker on the back of my hand shines against the gold of Hawthorne's helmet. I wrap my arms around his nape. His lips slip to my neck. I gasp softly. He groans, and the vibration fills me with fire. Hawthorne forces me harder against the wall. A thrilling ache of longing shudders inside me. "I've dreamt of kissing your skin," he murmurs, trailing his mouth over my flesh. "It's all I dream about." His lips find the hollow of my neck. He's the moon, and I'm a wolf willing to howl and commit mayhem to possess it. Hawthorne's hand grips me, and my eyes close, feeling the warmth of his touch to my marrow. My head falls forward. The iron sword points of my crown battle with the golden sickle-shaped blade of his helmet. He lifts his chin, finding my lips again, covering them with his. Opening my eyes, I reach for his helmet, sliding my fingers on either side of its dome. I lift it, pull it from his hair, and let it fall to the floor with a loud clang. My fingers tremble when I cup his face. He gazes into my eyes. "I walked the beach in swords where I last saw you," he says, "hoping to find you, even when I knew you weren't there. I thought I'd die without you. I'll give anything to be with you, my firstborn title, my wealth, my soul, all of it." I lean forward and kiss him. He groans again, as if I've stabbed him in the chest. "I missed you, too. What are we going to do, Hawthorne?" He hugs me to his chest. "Whatever it takes. I need you. Life without you is..." A harrowing scream resonates through the rumble of thunder in the holographic room. At first, I convince myself that I imagined it. But then more shrieks and cries bellow from beyond the corridor. Hawthorne goes rigid in my arms. He reaches past my shoulder, cutting off the storm effect sounds. My legs unwind from him, and my feet slip to the ground. He turns toward the closed door, listening. The ring of fusion mag pulses rises above a cacophony of panicked shouts. Hawthorne snatches up his helmet and settles it back on his head. He lifts his shield. The gold reflects the dim light of the storm-clouded room. He pauses by the door. I stop behind him. "Do you have a weapon?" I ask, while easing an iron rose from the belt around my waist. The points of the petals curve like claws. Hawthorne crouches down on one knee and flips his shield over. The underside has a wide grip that unlatches, revealing a golden dagger hidden within. "When do you know me not to have a weapon?" He grasps the hilt of the blade and extracts it from the shield before latching the handle back into place. He holds the shield in one hand and the dagger in the other. Using the shield, he nudges the door open a crack. I squat down behind him, lifting the iron rose to my hair. I cut the vine that holds my crown secure to my head, and then ease the circlet from its bed of thorns and roses. The iron crown is heavy in my fist. I wish I could cut out the rest of the vines, but they're woven into the braids. Movement. The sound of pounding feet. A woman dressed in black runs past the door, crying and stumbling. Blood and brain matter mottle her hair. Streaks of red and pieces of flesh, presumably not her own, dot the black eel skin of her costume. Recognizing her as one of the women who came in with my father, I bound up and leap over Hawthorne, pulling the door wide. Fusion mag pulses rip past my cheek, singeing a piece of my hair. I recoil. The bullet connects with the back of the woman's head, blowing her brains out through her face. Her body crumples. I turn to see who fired. A ghoulish man, dressed in all black with raven wings, aims his fusion mag at me. His face is covered by a black leather mask, but his lips are exposed in a sinister smile. He utters a single word. "Roselle." He pulls the trigger. Hawthorne lurches in front of me, holding up his golden shield. The metal dents in and sizzles. Hawthorne flinches and shouts in pain. I shift to Hawthorne's side, draw my arm back, and throw an iron rose. It embeds in the forehead of the dark-clad god of death, slicing through his skull and exposing the inside of his cranium. I throw two more, hitting his cheeks. He falls backward from the force, bouncing onto the floor. Holographic snowflakes shower down, but never reach his body. "Incoming!" Hawthorne shouts. He maneuvers around me with his shield in front of him. Another round of fusion pulses careen against it. He pushes me back into the room, closing the door. We crouch down. Hawthorne points. I nod and take the position he indicated, hugging the wall across from him. We wait. Fusion mag blasts shatter holes in the door. A gunman pushes it open, and Hawthorne stabs his dagger into one of his knees. The black-clad figure falls forward. I swing my crown down at him, slicing his arm. The iron blades cut through his muscles and the tendons, slicing his flesh to the bone. He screams in agony, drops the fusion mag, and writhes on the ground. A second gunman at the threshold fires at Hawthorne, who protects himself with his shield. I dive for the fusion mag the first assassin dropped. Rolling with it, I aim at the man in the doorway and pull the trigger. The pulse caves his face in. "They're all dressed like Vinson, the god of death," I mutter to Hawthorne. "Who sent you?" I demand of the writhing man beside me. Hawthorne crawls forward and claims the fusion mag from the dead gunman in the doorway. He gets to his feet and peeks around the corner. Chilling screams come from the main ballroom. The death god at my feet is bleeding out fast. The hue of his skin is ghostly white. Lifting my boot, I kick him hard in the side. "Who sent you?" The assassin smiles at me, his teeth smeared with blood. "You're gonna die," he croons in a sing-song voice. He bites down on a white tablet in his mouth. The cyanide goes to work immediately. His eyes roll back in his head, and froth trickles from the sides of his mouth. The rest of his body twitches. I look at his left hand. No moniker shines from it to indicate his fate. But there aren't any marks there. It's like he never had one. "We gotta move," Hawthorne urges, taking my arm and hauling me to my feet. "My father," I whisper shout. "I was following him." "Which way did he go?" Hawthorne mouths. I point in the opposite direction from the main ballroom. He nods, and we both peek out into the corridor. Golden fusion mag blasts light up the gallery entrance. Beyond the railing is the ballroom and the god's table one level below. Hawthorne strips his crimson cape from his shoulders and wraps it around his singed forearm before lifting the shield once more. He silently signals me to move away from the sound of the massacre. He steps out into the corridor with his shield arm held up and his fusion mag pointed in the direction of the main ballroom. I fall into place behind him. Threading my left arm through the circle of my crown, I let the iron hang on my wrist like a very large bracelet. I place my left hand on Hawthorne's shoulder. In my right hand, my fusion mag points away from him, protecting Hawthorne's back. Together, we inch away from the ballroom, one tentative footstep at a time. We pass several more rooms. Each time, I swing my weapon toward them, only to find them empty. The snowy scene on the wall of the corridor has a streak of blood spattered across it. I tap Hawthorne on the shoulder with the barrel of my fusion mag. He slows his pace. I pivot my gun in the direction of the room on my right. A death god runs into the winter corridor from the gallery. Hawthorne fires and picks the target off with one shot. The assassin crumbles onto the floor. Distracted, I miss the target at my side until almost the last second. The death god seizes my arm, wrenching the hand that holds the fusion mag. My other hand slips from Hawthorne's shoulder. The iron crown slides into my palm. The death god almost pries the fusion mag from me, but I swing the crown, slicing his jugular vein. He falls onto me, clutching my forearm, attempting to hold himself up while his blood gushes out. I slide the crown back on my wrist, clutching the dying man to me, and use him as a shield. The death god behind him shoots his accomplice several times in the back, struggling to hit me. I position my fusion mag under the now dead man's armpit and fire pulses into his partner. The hit man falls back, his head in pieces. I shrug off my human shield, letting him fall to the ground. I peer into the room. It's a bloody mess of body parts. A strange sound chokes from me. Beyond the dead assassin on the floor is the body of my father and two of the women he arrived with. They're in pieces. Kenneth's tongue has been cut out and placed in his hand. The ram's horns are twisted into his head for real. His eyes have been plucked out. Two more death gods infiltrate the winter corridor. Hawthorne picks them off. He looks past me into the room and swears softly.
Don't look, he whispers.
My shoulders round. I'm rooted in place.
We can't help him. He's gone. Move. Put your hand on my shoulder.
This isn't happening.
Put your hand on my shoulder,
Hawthorne repeats. I put my hand on his shoulder. Hawthorne takes another step backward, nudging me to do the same. A fusion mag pulse strikes the front of his shield. He swears again and returns fire, hitting one of the handful of death gods at the mouth of the winter corridor. Something inside me clicks. I maneuver around Hawthorne and his shield, raising my fusion mag. Squeezing the trigger in rapid succession, I strike each enemy in front of me with a shot to the head. Roselle! Hawthorne howls. I sprint toward the gallery. Behind me, Hawthorne's feet pound as he tries to keep up. They're looking for you, Roselle. They'll kill everyone until they find you. Well, here I am, I snarl as I rush into the gallery. Then I stop, overlooking the ballroom and the god's table. Carnage everywhere. A crush of firstborns is trying to move up the glass stairs. The gallery is lined with death gods firing into the mob. The black-clad devils are swarming the god's table as well. The door to the balcony where I last saw Clifton and Dune has been barricaded against the horde. I pick off a handful of death gods without even trying. Another one rushes at me from the side. I swing my iron crown, slashing his face and blinding him. I cross my arm over my abdomen and shoot him in the chest. Blood spatters the wall. Touching my moniker, I engage the hover discs on the soles of my boots. Skating forward as if on ice, I gain momentum. With my arm out straight, I shoot every death god in my path. In my peripheral vision, a black-clad figure, the feathers of his raven wings stretched wide, flies right into me, knocking me over the gallery railing. The hover discs thwart our fall as the winged assassin seizes me around my waist and lifts his gun to my temple. Before he can fire, I throw my head back, breaking his nose. I trigger the bracer on my left arm, and the blade thrusts out. I stab downward, cutting open his thigh. He lets go, but his hover pack keeps him airborne. I touch my moniker, and my hover discs turn off. My hair whips past my face as I fall toward the ballroom floor. I re-engage the hover discs just inches from the glass tiles. Lifting my fusion mag, I aim at the dark-winged god above me, shooting him out of the air. When he hits the ballroom floor, he doesn't move. A horde of death gods on this level does battle with a few of Valdi's security personnel. Bodies litter the ground all around me. From the pocket of my leather costume, I extract the rose-colored goggles Crystal gave me and set them on the bridge of my nose. Lifting my right arm, I twist the rose-shaped emblem on the bracer. Red powder sprays out in a sprawling crimson cloud that billows like a shifting sandstorm. The dust swirls, blinding the death gods and everyone else in its path. Blood-red tears, the hallmark of the goddess of war, weep from my victim's eyes. I stride through my hunched-over enemies, blowing holes in their heads. When I reach the far end of the ballroom, a death god, standing by the wall of glass, holds up a grenade. Crying tears of blood, he pushes the detonator down with his thumb. Rapid flashes of light pulse from it, warning of impending destruction. First yellow. I engage my hover discs and skate toward him. Then orange. From somewhere above me in the gallery, Hawthorne calls my name. Then red. I plow into the death god and hug him to me, knocking us both through the window and out into the night sky. Jagged shards of glass scatter around us like a thousand stars, cutting us both. He lets go of the grenade, which falls from his fingers. Silently, I brace myself, counting the seconds to detonation, and then... boom! Fire blows out in every direction. The wind from the explosion pushes us upward. The death god clings to me, screaming. As he hugs me, I clutch the fabric covering his chest, holding him like a shield from the impact of the grenade. His body blocks the shrapnel and keeps the flames from engulfing me. Metal riddles his back, but I remain mostly unscathed. His grip loosens, and I let go of him. He falls from me into the black cloud, disappearing from my sight. I begin to fall as well. I try to gain control of the hover discs on the soles of my feet, only to realize that one has been ripped from my boot. The other one can't keep me aloft on its own. I lose altitude. Slowly, at first, but as I fall into the choking black cloud of smoke, I gain speed. I can't see anything except for the lights below me, growing closer by the second. I dial up the power of the hover disc, which slows me down some, but it won't matter when I hit the ground at this velocity. I'm going too fast. Bracing myself, I shut my eyes. I'd forgotten about the lake, and the shock of hitting the water is overwhelming. My entire body feels as if it will break apart. Water fills my lungs. I can't breathe. I'm unable to tell which way is up in the darkness. On the verge of blacking out, I feel someone tug a fistful of my hair. An arm encircles my waist. I'm listless. Water gushes into my nostrils. It hardly registers when I break the plane of the surface. "Roselle," Hawthorne growls in my ear. "Breathe." Brutally strong arms around my waist. Something presses beneath my sternum, thrusting upward several times. Water leaves my lungs, flowing from my nose and mouth. I cough and gasp. Hawthorne's arms shift. One crosses my chest, and Hawthorne drags us through the water with side strokes and scissors kicks. We reach the shore. Hawthorne wades with me to a low wall. He yanks my limp body from the lake. Sitting on the stone edge, me on his lap, he tries to catch his breath. Roses hang in my face. He snatches them from my hair and tosses them away. My goggles are gone, washed away at the bottom of the lake. Touching my cheek, Hawthorne pats it lightly. "Don't die," he whispers hoarsely. I open my eyes. Water drips from Hawthorne's chin onto my chest. He lost his helmet at some point. The thorns in my hair dig painfully into my back. My hand struggles to reach his. I touch his skin, and my silver holographic sword entwines with his gold one before my fingers slip limply from him. He lifts me in his arms and carries me over the wall and into the night. Chapter 9. Something Left Behind. The inside of Hawthorne's chrome airship has that new craft smell. Quietly shivering, I feel my lips tremble. Water drips from my hair, sliding down my shoulders and arms. Droplets of red blood from scratches and cuts from broken glass and thorns stain the creamy leather of the co-pilot seat. Hawthorne leans into the cockpit, fawning over me. He grasps the straps of the seat, securing them over my shoulders. The thorns in my hair dig into my skin. I wince. Hawthorne scowls. "Who put these vines in your hair? It's completely asinine." He tugs my bristly braids from behind my back, laying my hair over the seat back. I don't answer him because the violence of my chattering teeth won't allow it. "I left you in the hands of a bunch of sadists." He opens a compartment next to me. Inside is a small aerosol device containing CR40, a topical polymer. He shakes the can and coats the skin of my left hand with the chemical. The silver sword of my moniker dims, and then goes dark. I reach up and touch his cheek, finding it almost hot compared to my icy fingers. He's cut up, too. Bruises are forming on his jaw and chin, and under one eye. His bottom lip is swelling. Seared skin on his forearm is red and angry. His hand envelops mine for a moment, and the fierceness of his stare warms me. Then he straightens and closes my door. Hawthorne comes around the airship, touches a fingerprint panel, and the pilot's door lifts. He seats himself, and the door glides down, locking in place. The engines fire with serious growls that only erupt from a premium airship with power upgrade modifications. He must have spent a fortune on it. As if reading my mind, Hawthorne mutters, "I didn't buy this. It was a gift from my parents. Or maybe not a gift. Maybe a bribe." He doesn't bother to spray his own hand with the CR-40, but tosses it behind his seat. The golden glow of his holographic sword shines between us. Reaching over, Hawthorne touches a light on a holographic cockpit board. Heat radiates from a vent in front of me. I lean forward, extending my juddering fingertips to it. We lift off into the night sky. The windscreen in front of us modifies, illuminating the terrain, making it discernible as if everything is bathed in the first blush of morning light.